Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday the 18th of May, these are our main stories. Shops, hairdressers, museums and restaurants reopen in Italy 10 weeks on from the start of the lockdown. China's President Xi Jinping addresses a virtual meeting of the World Health Organization's 194 member countries. And a million people face evacuation as what could be a super cyclone approaches India's east coast. Also in this podcast,
the company claims they were premium mannequins and not X-rated adult toys, but it seems difficult to believe.
An audience of sex dolls as South Korea's football league resumes. After months of lockdown, countries in Europe have today taken further measures to restart their economies and edge towards normal life. In a moment, we'll hear from our correspondent in Brussels about the big picture across the continent. But first, let's focus on Italy. 10 weeks after imposing one of the world's toughest lockdowns, the country is reopening shops, restaurants, hairdressers and museums. From Milan, Mark Lowen sent us this report.
Nothing says Milan more than fashion, and this road, Via Monte Napoleone, is the heart of it all. There's Gucci here, Dolce & Gabbana, here's Salvatore Ferragamo and Valentino. It really is the chic heart of this city. For 10 weeks, they, like the rest of this country, have been locked down, depriving Italy of one of its economic motors. But today, they reopen. And at the store of designer Alberta Ferretti, they're getting ready. Inside, behind the shutters, they're hanging the latest collections of silk and lace dresses. And they're putting in their hygiene measures too. A glass screen in front of the cash desk and notices to customers to wash their hands and wear face masks. Julia Peterson is the store's director.
It has been hard, actually, very hard, because nothing was sure. So we kept on listening to the news and we didn't know what to expect.
Was there ever a moment where you thought, are we ever going to be able to come back to work?
No, never.
The trams winding their way through Italy's financial capital are fuller now. The city is coming back to life. It was at the centre of the Italian outbreak, the first cases nearby. Over 15,000 people have died in this region, almost half of all Italy's deaths. And the economic pain is intense. A third of businesses here won't be able to reopen today. Milan is wounded, but those out on the piazza beside the iconic cathedral feel it's on the mend.
I believe that people understood how they have to manage this situation. So I believe that everybody will give his contribute to the reopening. I believe in the Milanese power.
Just opposite Milan train station is a 17-storey brown skyscraper that is the Hotel Michelangelo. And this is now Hotel Quarantine, because this is the temporary home for people who have been discharged from hospital but are waiting to test negative, or people who've tested positive for the virus and are worried about infecting the friends and family that they live with. Italy is reopening. The outbreak is more under control. But still, 200 people a day are staying here.
After 20 days, Jacqueline Chuquitarco Suarez is ready to be discharged.
I have to say thanks to the government here, to Italy, because they saved my life. To the doctors, the nurses, the care I received has been so great. Thank God I'm going back home. For me, it was a horrible experience because death stared me in the face, and now it's like being born again. Thanks to everyone and to Italy, I'm still alive.
as Jacqueline is met by her daughter and brother, a musical patient from the 15th floor opens his window to serenade their emotional reunion. After 3 months of hell, Italy is taking another step towards healing.
Mark Lowen. Belgium is also easing restrictions today, despite having one of the world's highest COVID-19 mortality rates. Many in the country are welcoming the slow return to normality, but not everyone is impressed with the Prime Minister, Sophie Wilmès. I asked our correspondent Gavin Lee about the reception medical staff gave her at a hospital in Brussels at the weekend.
Basically, as she arrived in a motorcade, the doctors and nurses waiting in two lines outside to greet the motorcade formed what they call a guard of dishonour. They all silently turned their backs on the motorcade, refused to look at her. Incredibly organised. It had been picked up and it's been filmed and sort of made it around the world in terms of the footage as well. Very striking. And part of the reason, the staff say, is this is one of the worst hit hospitals of the past few weeks, actually, where people were overwhelmed, where a number of the patients had to be moved elsewhere in Belgium, and they say this is about working conditions, this is about low pay, long hours, and not being given enough PPE. So, strong protest. Sophie Wilmès hasn't spoken since then, but today, of course, Belgium starts to significantly reopen its lockdown.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, schools, markets, museums and zoos all reopening, so the medic's unhappy, but the country is changing.
Yeah, so today, primary schools, secondary schools reopen. Just some classes, year six, year seven, selected different days of the week. The reality is some of the classes will have four, five, no more than that to a class, and actually that will mean pupils have, on average, one day of lessons a week, and it's not compulsory either. Zoos, as you say, museums, they have to be booked online only, so you keep numbers down, and you can have sports centres, gyms, and people meeting in the park to play football, but no more than 20 people together.
And more widely, Gavin, across Europe, there is a gradual reopening of often things like tourist sites, the Acropolis in Greece, and in many countries, cafes and restaurants reopening. How are they doing that, though, with the social distancing measures that are required?
Yes, I mean, different places, different things. So Sweden, for example, you know, we know that they've kept their bars, their cafes open with social distancing in place, so you have to be served sitting down and you can't, you know, stand up and have bar service. Some places, it's like Denmark, it's four people per table. The Greeks are saying that when they open restaurants and cafes next week, it'll be six people per table, and the staff have to wear face masks in. And you know, countries have, for example, marked out where you can sit, where you can't sit. For Belgium, one bit of good news as well today is that one of the famous breweries in the world is an abbey that makes a beer called Westvleteren 12. It's been voted the best beer in the world for 2 years running. That is reopening. The monks are starting to make the beer again, and we're told this morning there are already queues of traffic outside the abbey.
Gavin Lee in Belgium. How to prevent a pandemic like COVID-19 from happening again? That's the question world leaders have been debating at a virtual annual meeting of the World Health Organization. The organization's Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, says a global response to this pandemic has been undermined by disunity.
We do not yet know how to eradicate, treat or vaccinate against COVID-19. And we have no clear idea when we'll be able to do these things. But the fragility exposed by the virus is not limited to our health systems. It affects all areas of our world and our institutions. COVID-19 must be a wake-up call. It is time for an end of this hubris. Our deep feelings of powerlessness must lead to greater humility. Deadly global threats require a new unity and solidarity.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping has insisted his country has acted responsibly in its handling of the coronavirus pandemic, which originated in central China's Hunan province. He also said that China would support a review of the global response to COVID-19 when the pandemic was over.
In China, after making painstaking efforts and enormous sacrifice, we have turned the tide on the virus and protected the life and health of our people. All along, we have acted with openness, transparency and responsibility. We have provided information to the WHO and the relevant countries in the most timely fashion.
President Xi also said China will provide $2 billion over the next 2 years to help fight COVID-19 and offered help for health infrastructure in Africa. But even before the meeting began, there were fears political disputes would dominate, especially given Taiwan hasn't been able to take part despite some success in containing the virus. The country's status is, of course, controversial, as our correspondent in Switzerland, Imogen Folkes, explains.
Taiwan, not a UN member state because China views it as part of China. It has over years asked for observer status at the World Health Assembly, particularly wanted to be there this year, has not received an invitation from the World Health Organization. Not because the World Health Organization is itself closing the door on Taiwan, but because the WHO leadership said the member states have to decide. And at this point, Taiwan has now said, we'll wait until later in the year and we'll focus on the coronavirus. Also, probably, Taiwan knew it would not get enough support to be granted member status and it didn't want to set that precedent.
This is very much a political meeting, though. Can it really do anything that will help the world tackle the pandemic?
Interestingly, there seems to be an albeit fragile consensus gathering around a resolution from the European Union, which calls for global unity to develop treatments and vaccines and to make sure that those are shared fairly around the world, that everyone has access, a people's vaccine almost, if you like, which would mean not one country buying up all the stocks or not one pharma company having the patent for 10 years to sell it as it likes. Now, the United States may have some objections to this. It has been going it alone on vaccine development so far, hasn't joined the global effort. But what I'm hearing from diplomats is that there does appear to be some consensus, and it would be an achievement if that resolution got passed. It also, by the way, calls for the WHO to have, as soon as is possible, a independent evaluation of how the pandemic was tackled. And obviously, many, many countries want to look at that. How did we do as individual countries? How did the first country do? That's China. And above all, how did the World Health Organization do as the body we look to guide us in a health crisis like this?
Imogen Folkes. It sounded like a good idea. Instead of football matches being played in empty stadiums, during the pandemic, a South Korean football team thought it would fill the seats with mannequins. But it didn't go according to plan, as I heard from our correspondent in Seoul, Laura Bicker.
The K-League has been playing for a couple of weeks now in front of empty stadiums. In fact, it's even been broadcast on the BBC as people desperate for a sport are kind of watching K-League soccer, which is the kind of first sport in the world to kind of start getting going. However, obviously with these empty stadiums, it seemed a nice idea to fill them. So some company came along to Seoul FC and said, hey, look, what if we put some mannequins in there? And Seoul FC said, okay, that sounds like a good idea. Now, this company was called Dalcom. Unfortunately, Seoul FC didn't look into the company. And when the mannequins turned up, we spoke to the press officer today and he's told us that he was aware that they looked, how should we say, more human than normal, but he thought maybe this was the kind of premium mannequin that he was getting. When the game was broadcast, this was Seoul FC against Gwangju, the cameras panned to the stands and a number of shocked viewers who were kind of looking at these, shall we call them, premium mannequins in tight Seoul FC football strips, noticed them and started sharing their pictures on social media, quite shocked because they believed they were indeed sex dolls.
Let's not wonder how those viewers knew that, but some of these mannequins were even holding little notices advertising sex websites, weren't they?
Well, yes. And now remember, pornography isn't legal in South Korea, but they were advertising some websites which seemed to have been for certain viewership, yes. And so Seoul FC certainly has apologised. The company claims they were premium mannequins and not X-rated adult toys. But it seems difficult to believe that perhaps that they were premium mannequins when they were holding such signs. And when you look at them, again, I'm not going to go into specific details, but it's not the kind of premium mannequin I've seen in a local department store.
Okay. Laura, while we've got you there, just generally, I mean, South Korea at the beginning of this crisis was one of the hot spots. Then things got a lot better. What's it like now?
Well, we had a spike in cases after a nightclub outbreak here in Seoul and in 81. And a lot of people were really worried because it was feared that they wouldn't be able to get it under control because perhaps people wouldn't come forward, especially as a number of these nightclubs were for the LGBTQ community. And they faced real prejudice here. So there was a fear that people would not want to come forward and be tested. They introduced anonymous testing, so you don't have to give your name now. Over 60,000 people have come forward. They've tracked, traced and tested over 60,000 people. They believe they've now found 170 people in total who've been infected. But today, for instance, the number of domestic cases is back in single digits, 5 cases after that nightclub cluster. So they are kind of remaining on edge. They are still tracking and tracing, but it does appear that they have got this latest outbreak under control.
Laura Bicker.
I mean, how does your wife feel about that idea?
My wife tolerates it because I guess there are worse things I could do.
Grown men making Disneyland in Lego, the latest cure for lockdown boredom. And now to Hong Kong. The sound of scuffles in the legislative chamber between pro-democracy and pro-government representatives over a row for the leadership of a key committee. Our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton told me what happened.
This is the second time we've seen very dramatic scenes on the floor of the Hong Kong legislature. And it all sounds a bit bureaucratic, but yes, it's over which side, which a group of politicians, the pro-Beijing politicians who have the majority in the legislature right now, or the opposition, which really has control over this key committee, the House committee. That's because any legislation that gets passed, any laws that get put into practice, have to pass through this committee first. And for months, for 7 months now, the opposition has been really trying to control this committee in order to stop legislation passing through. Well, now the pro-Beijing politicians have been getting a little bit of help, it seems, from the guards who guard the legislature. They have been helping the pro-Beijing politicians to first take over control of this committee and then now to elect a chairperson who's a pro-Beijing person who will then go on to set the agenda and presumably start to allow some of this legislation to pass through the committee and get closer to being passed into law.
And there's a law being planned that will make it illegal to disrespect the Chinese national anthem.
That's right. This is the National Anthem Law. It's a law, it's a proposed law in Hong Kong that mirrors a law that is already in practice in mainland China. It came about because when the Chinese national anthem was being played in Hong Kong, you'll remember that Hong Kong is a semi-autonomous territory, part of China. When the national anthem would be played, it was often booed by people in Hong Kong, which was of great embarrassment to China's political leaders in Beijing. So they are trying to encourage the passing of a national anthem law, which would make insulting the Chinese national anthem something that's punishable by up to 3 years in prison or a $6,000 fine.
Very briefly, Celia, the pro-democracy movement, this does show it's still thriving despite the coronavirus restrictions.
Absolutely. I think there have been a lot of calls for huge protests on May 27th. That's when we'll be likely seeing another reading of this Hong Kong National Anthem Law that will be read in the Hong Kong legislature. So already on social media, we're seeing calls for people to turn out into the streets on that day to protest that law, which many people say will just erode freedom of expression in Hong Kong even more.
Celia Hatton. India and Bangladesh are bracing for a severe cyclone that's been developing in the Bay of Bengal. Cyclone Umpan is expected to make landfall later this week. Here's how the BBC's weather broadcaster Nick Miller described the threat.
We've been watching a cyclone Umpan develop, strengthen in the Bay of Bengal, and it is moving north. And on the current forecast track, it is expected to make landfall probably late Wednesday around West Bengal in India, but close to the border with Bangladesh as well. It will be bringing some heavy rain towards Odisha, very windy along the coastline, as then it moves closer towards that coastline of West Bengal. Kolkata very much in the zone for seeing some heavy rain, and of course into Bangladesh as well. May still be some fluctuations in strength, and the track of this system, so as ever, keep across the latest forecast. But again, landfall late Wednesday, West Bengal, Bangladesh, most at risk from seeing these winds that could be gusting around 185 kilometres per hour. So destructive winds, flooding rain and a storm surge hitting the coastline as well.
Both India and Bangladesh have begun evacuating people from the danger areas. I spoke to our correspondent in Mumbai, Yogita Limoye, about the challenge of moving people to safety.
Obviously, the problem really compounded right now because of the coronavirus crisis as well. So you can't, you've got to try to follow social distancing, all of the other norms, wearing masks, etc., even when you're moving people to shelters. The National Disaster Management Chief in India, in fact, talked about this, saying this is actually a dual challenge for us now because we've got to get people out, but we've got to make sure that they don't, in the process, get infected with coronavirus. And some of the areas, at least in India, which have to be evacuated or which are likely to be in the path of this storm, are places where we have seen sort of COVID cases coming up. In India, the Prime Minister has just chaired a meeting with the National Disaster Response Teams as well as the Ministry of Home Affairs. A bulk of, the evacuation process actually is scheduled to happen tomorrow, through the day. All of these areas surrounding the coast, they're quite used to being hit by cyclones. So these processes are really, they're aware of it. They do it every year. But of course, this year, the problem is far more intense because of coronavirus as well.
Yeah, the number I've heard and seen on the wires is 1 million people. How do you move 1 million people in this space of time?
Well, over the decades, I think, this is sort of that time, every year, end of May, June, all the way up to sort of the end of the year, they are hit by sort of pretty severe cyclonic storms. Last year as well, we saw Orissa being really hit hard by a storm, but the loss of life was very, very little. So evacuation processes, evacuation drills, this is something India is very used to doing. Bangladesh as well, has regularly hit by cyclones. In fact, what they've said actually, because they also had a disaster management meeting. And one of the things they're doing is that apart from the existing storm shelters, they are trying to convert any other sort of places like schools as well into shelters so that they're able to follow a sort of social distancing norms in those places. In both countries, disaster management teams are active.
Yogita Limoye. The economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic is becoming clearer, and the latest figures from Japan show that in the first 3 months of this year, the world's third largest economy shrank by 3.5%. It means that Japan is now in recession. And as our correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes reports from Tokyo, experts believe there could be grimmer news to come.
The Japanese government had been expecting GDP to fall by as much as 5% in the first quarter of 2020. So these figures are, to an extent, good news. They show domestic demand from Japanese consumers only slipped slightly in the period January to March. Exports have, however, been hit hard, falling 6%. Much worse is expected to come. The full impact of the coronavirus pandemic didn't hit Japan until April, when a nationwide state of emergency was declared, forcing much of the retail and entertainment sectors to close down. Economists are predicting a much bigger 20% fall in GDP in the second quarter. If so, it would be the biggest fall recorded in Japan's peacetime history. But there is also some hope that Japan will be able to reopen its economy fairly quickly. There has not been a European-style lockdown here, and yet Japan has so far succeeded in keeping deaths from coronavirus to less than 1,000.
Rupert Wingfield-Hayes. Staying in Japan, authorities have decided to close the main routes to the top of Mount Fuji, the nation's highest summit and a UNESCO heritage site. I asked Henry Bellow why this decision had been made.
Well, they're very concerned because they're worried that this mountain could become a real hotspot for coronavirus infections. And that's because it's become so popular with tourists, not just in Japan, but internationally. So just last year, for example, about 260,000 people climbed to the top of it. It really is a must-see for so many tourists. I mean, there's those iconic images, really. It's a mountain, if you're not familiar with it. It's triangle-shaped. It's often covered in this sort of perfect snow cap. But the four trails up it particularly are quite narrow at some point. So when you've got hundreds of thousands of people going up it during a very short climbing season, the paths are congested and there is this risk that people are going to be very close to each other. Also that the virus might be shared in some of the cabins along the way. You've also got to have provisions for first aid. So the local authorities just can't guarantee that people will be safe and the virus won't spread. So they're closing these routes.
Presumably this will have a big impact on the local economy.
Yeah, you mentioned there that Japan is officially now in recession. A lot of industries have been hit really hard. Well, tourism is a key factor in this, especially tourists from abroad. We know that they spend more money when they come. They tend to eat out, stay at restaurants. So by closing this, it has a big impact on the local economy. All the hotels and businesses that need to cater for them, they're going to be hit hard. And that is another additional strain, really, on the Japanese economy as it tries to recover from this pandemic.
Henry Bellow. Lots of us are being very resourceful during this age of lockdown, trying to find things to fill the time. We're going to take you to Texas now, and the man who's created a complete miniature replica of Disneyland using Lego. What's more, John Wayne Doherty did it in just one day and told his wife and two children the room would be Lego-free afterwards. His two videos of the event have had a huge amount of interest on YouTube. We won't share them with you because, to be honest, they're very visual and don't really work for podcasts. But John Wayne Doherty has been talking to Claire McDonnell.
This started 4 years ago because a Ferris wheel set had come out that Lego made. And I'm a big theme park, amusement park person anyway, whether it's Six Flags or Disney or whatever. And so when that set came out, Ferris wheel's always been my favorite ride, so I had to get that ride. I got it at a used Lego store that they have here in America, and that's what started it.
Well, I've seen the video, and it's incredible. Talk us through then when you thought, right, I'm going to put all of this together now. I started a few years ago, and now lockdown gives me this opportunity.
Yeah, so I had more time, obviously, like we all have had more time, and I was working basically from home, and so I asked my wife one day, hey, can I just clear all the furniture out of the dining room and let me set this stuff up? And then, you know, I promise I'll put it all back away by the end of the day. And so I set it up for the first time, you know, the way I kind of had been seeing it in my head over the years. And I did a couple of videos and took a few pictures and then I put it away. And, you know, that was on April the 28th that I posted that information to some Disney fan sites that I'm on Facebook, and someone on there found it, and then it just took off.
So you were good to your word then, because normally if you say, oh, yeah, just give me that room, it'll be gone by the end of the day. I can imagine your wife was thinking, will it really? But you did. You just set it all up, took the video and took it all down again?
Literally. The videos, I took two of them and they're each one was one take. That's it. I didn't sit there and thoughtfully think up what I was going to do. That one take where I take the, you know, the camera on the phone down and you see up Main Street to the castle and the train goes by. All that was by chance. I didn't coordinate it. It just happened.
So what now then? Because you've had such interest in all of this. I mean, do you want to have a permanent installation at home? Do you want to add to it? I mean, how do your wife feel about that idea?
Well, right now, you know, the rooms are taken up with these children. So one day when the children leave, there'll be an empty room somewhere that I hope to put it up permanently.
Lego fan John Wayne Doherty. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
This podcast is brought to you by Uma. If you're a small business owner, now more than ever, you understand the importance of being able to adapt so you can always be there for your customers. Uma Office is a cloud-based business phone service that gives small business owners the flexibility needed to run a business efficiently from anywhere. With features like mobile and desktop apps, a virtual receptionist, and call recording, you can do more for less. Uma Office starts at $19.95 per user per month with no contracts. To learn more, go to uma.com or call 833-TRY-OOMA.